This episode of She Explores is brought to you by Oru Kayak. They design folding kayaks that can go virtually anywhere, thanks to their lightweight and folding design. Stay tuned for later in the episode. We'll talk to blogger Erin Outdoors about why she loves packing it in on her hikes. Learn more at www.orukayak.com. I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores.
My friend Alex, who hiked the PCT last year while I was hiking the AT, I would look at his Instagram, and it would just be breathtaking view. Oh my goodness, this mountain, these rivers that they had to ford, you know, the Sierras, incredible stuff. I would look at my Instagram pictures, and it was like, this rock is in the shape of a heart. It was small beauty, you know, it was check out this rattlesnake. It was look at the way that the snow has draped these branches.
I love this phrase, small beauty, because it so perfectly describes the East Coast. Rahawa Hale has a knack for noticing small beauty. She hiked the Appalachian Trail last year, and as much as she wishes it weren't noticeable, she was one of the few Black women to thru-hike in 2016. Along the way, she carried the metaphorical weight of that knowledge, as well as the physical weight of paperback books, for a project she'll tell us about later in the episode. I chose to call this episode Small Beauty on the Appalachian Trail because I think that kind of beauty goes beyond aesthetic. Rahawa sees beauty in everyday life, in words, in movement, especially in people. And based on our conversation, that beauty was clarified on the trail, even if we as a society have a long way to go. Rahawa Hale is a writer living in Oakland, California. I discovered her through an essay she wrote for BuzzFeed about her experience on the trail, and I was subsequently drawn into her Twitter account. Yes, it was political and intelligent and poetic, but it also contained a lot of photos of clouds. I asked her about them.
Well, let me tell you about clouds. I grew up in Miami. Very hot, lots of convection. The clouds were massive in a place that's mostly flat. And most cumulus clouds are, what, somewhere under 2,000 feet in elevation, which is very small for a mountain. But this is also a place without mountains, Florida in general. They were the tallest thing I could see. And they enchanted me. Their shapes enchanted me. The way they moved enchanted me. They kind of held this fascination of this like unreachable height in my everyday. But they were also just beautiful. But my little branch of Cloud Twitter started because things were rough. Things were just very rough in my life with the news cycle and whatever. And I just wanted to take a moment to pause and say, listen, here's something beautiful that is just outside your window. And I know things are hard right now, but taking a second for yourself to look at these clouds might do you a bit of good. And it did. It did me a world of good. I think it's just an opportunity to pause that way and to not feel like there's so much coming at you at once.
I think a lot of people think of South Florida as not being particularly outdoorsy, so I'm interested in what your entry point was to the outdoors.
You touch on something interesting, and that's what the common perception of outdoorsy means. And that's it's very narrow. You know, you say someone, oh, he's outdoorsy, and you might think maybe he rock climbs, or it's a he, period, or they're into hiking and doing weekend backpacking trips. But South Florida is plenty outdoorsy. I mean, I grew up canoeing and kayaking and snorkeling and doing all kinds of mostly water-based outdoorsy sports, but I was always outside. I was always running around outside. South Florida has the Everglades. South Florida has the Keys. South Florida has Miami Beach. South Florida has a lot to recommend it as far as the natural world goes. But I think it gets lost because it's also Miami and South Beach and the glam and the glitz and the wealth.
I read a piece that you wrote for Pacific Standard. I think it was about a year ago. You were living in New York. It was before you hiked the Appalachian Trail, I'm assuming. And you said that there are moments in New York when I'm thinking of home, which means I'm thinking of a vanishing. I loved reading that and hearing your thoughts on the idea of home not being this permanent thing. And also because literally Miami will probably be underwater at some point. And it also made me think about your own heritage and where your family comes from. And well, I was wondering if that feeling of vanishing parallels that at all.
Absolutely. I come from Eritrea, a country in the Horn of Africa, north of Ethiopia. And if you look at the past, let's say, roughly 150 years, it's been one of erasure, of colonized by Italy, under British rule after World War II, annexed by Ethiopia, and fighting for independence for 30 years. It's just been one form of subjugation after another. And I think what's hard right now is that the current president of my country has made things very difficult for people to thrive. There's indefinite mandatory military service there, which is why up until last year, my country was the number one country of origin for refugees drowning in the Mediterranean trying to reach Italy. It's hard because the history of the country now, for the past few years, is one of this depletion. And the history of Florida, what I think of when I think of Miami, is something similar, although far more tangible, far more land-based, a literal erosion. But erosion is something I think of all the time. And I know things are always changing, but for me, I feel like I come from a people and from a place that is on the threat of disappearing at all times.
How does that make you feel from like a personal identity standpoint?
It makes me feel anxious. I'm constantly afraid.
I don't have a clean audio cut, but Rahawa went on to say, in more eloquent words, that she is constantly aware of what's going on in the world. Being from Eritrea and growing up in Miami has profoundly impacted her attention to political action and climate change, whether it relates to famine in Somalia or erosion in southern Florida. Much of her writing speaks to that keen awareness based on her and her family's experiences. I asked her why she decided to hike the Appalachian Trail in 2016.
I was in a place in my life where things felt very stagnant, but I was also in a place in my life where I was free. I didn't have a mortgage, I didn't have car payments, I didn't have children, I was in fairly good health. I didn't need to really do anything other than move out of my apartment and leave my cat with a friend and take off. I know this isn't what moved my spirit to tackle mountains. But as far as why I did it, number one is I knew I had an opportunity to do it. And I don't think that's emphasized enough, or that it's something that people have asked me enough about. There is a great deal of privilege in having the freedom to do something like this. That goes beyond race, beyond class. The fact that I'm able-bodied and that this was something that seemed even remotely attainable is a blessing. As for why I did the Appalachian Trail, as opposed to, going on vacation anywhere and traveling the world or something like that, I'd felt very stagnant. I had a desk job for 3.5 years. I'd never felt more divorced from my body. I'm a writer. I spend a lot of time sitting and thinking. And over those 3.5 years, when I worked this job, I would wake up in the morning and go to work and come home and spend my time seated, either at my writing desk or consuming media that I would then write about, and the rest of the time I was asleep. I felt very distant. I felt severed from the natural world in a way I'd never experienced, and I felt distanced from my body in a way that was depressing. And so I've always loved the outdoors, as we discussed. I grew up in the outdoors, and I first climbed a mountain about 2 years before I left for the Appalachian Trail. My friend took me on a hike up Bear Mountain, my good friend John Coyne, with Bear Mountains on the Appalachian Trail. And I followed those blazes for the first time, and I thought, wow, to follow those blazes, to see them, and to feel my muscles burning, and to see that view up top, and to think that that was possible for over 2,000 miles, meant something, and it moved me. And so I started to prepare, and I started to save up. And about a year ago, I was 2 weeks out from starting that journey.
Did you feel more connected to your body just in the preparation for the AT?
Yes and no. I went on several shakedown hikes, tested out gear, I tried to find the right shoes. I did not succeed in finding the right shoes until I hit the trail, but I was moving, but I was also scrambling to wrap up my life as I knew it. I'd spent 7 years moving from apartment to apartment in New York, finally having to get rid of most of what I had, because you carry a lot of your trash. When you move, you just say, okay, I'll deal with this after the move. And I didn't for 7 years. And so it was difficult to whittle my belongings down to 14 boxes. I was also working nonstop. I was trying to figure out my health insurance. I was just about to quit my job. And so I wish I could say something like I spent the month or two before I left for my hike doing nothing but hiking and getting into shape and dehydrating food. Well, that's not the truth. I spent it doing what I was doing before, just more anxiously.
Did that anxiety follow you onto the trail?
Anxiety's followed me everywhere. But the great thing about the trail is that it was the place where I finally managed to dodge it, to leave it behind. I've never been less anxious in my life than I was for those 6 months on the trail. And that was a profound experience for me because I didn't think it was possible. I didn't think it was possible to just get up and spend the day moving and to feel overjoyed by that movement and by that beauty and by that nature and by that camaraderie, because so much of the trail is about the trail community. And believe you me, the thru hiking community is one of the best communities I've ever belonged to, one of the kindest and most giving. But to feel that every day, to feel that freedom and to feel that centered and that grounded and that welcomed, I've never experienced anything like that.
What were the reactions of your friends and family when you decided to hike the AT?
My friends were very supportive. One of the first friends I told was a man named Douglas. He said something that stuck with me. He said, it sounds like what you need for where you are in your life, based on the conversations that we'd had. And it was a moment where I truly felt seen by a friend. My family was a different situation. I tell the story. My mother seriously thought I was going to show up in Georgia with a bottle of water in one hand and a machete in the other and somehow find my way to Maine. She didn't know anything about the Appalachian Trail. She just heard that her black daughter was showing up in the South alone and walking through the woods. And it was a great source of fear for her. But she started to read. She started to research. She read A Walk in the Woods, of course, but that didn't assuage her fears. But she started to read through hiking blogs and learn more about the trail. She went from being that woman to about 2 months into my hike, sending me text messages that said, have you back flushed your water filter recently? And I remember looking at my phone thinking, get out. Is this the same person? That is this ridiculous. And by the end of my hike, I don't think she's ever been more proud of me.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever think about inviting her to join you for a little bit of it?
No, I didn't. But I think she would have been game. I think if I had said, meet me in the Smokies and we'll go on a hike, we'll hike Clingman's Dome, we'll go on this walk and come back down, a day hike. I don't know that she's prepared for an overnight trip, but my mother is a very brave woman, and I hope that I get to go on an adventure with her very soon.
You read a lot of thru hiking blogs before you did the trail as well, right?
Oh, obsessively. I mean, it's how I got into it. After I got a taste of the trail, I started looking and trying to live vicariously through these other hikers. And you know, it was also a kind of way of asking myself, is this something I could do? Oh yeah, this is something I could do. This is something that doesn't frighten me. I'm more than happy to not shower for a week. You know, it's not like that's something that I put on my dating profile. But you know, I started to see how this was something that didn't seem unattainable, that didn't have aspects to it that were too much for me, you know? And I think a lot of that is because of how I grew up outdoors.
So in some ways you saw yourself in those thru hiking blogs.
Well, I saw the potential for the kind of freedom that I felt as a kid, for the kind of joy that I felt kayaking with my dad in the Everglades.
I talk with Rahawa about the people she met on the trail after a word from our sponsor, Oru Kayak. The folks at Oru Kayak believe that connecting to nature is a deep human need, even for those of us who live in cities. We talked to Erin Sullivan, the blogger behind Erin Outdoors, about where she takes her Oru Kayak in the wild.
I am loosely based in Colorado, and the cool thing about an Oeru kayak is that it goes on your back. So I have been able to hike my Oeru kayak to some really beautiful alpine lakes that normally don't get to see kayaks. I think getting out on the water in a place like a alpine lake in Colorado, it's not something that you're really used to. It shifts your perspective because you don't have to walk all the way around the lake to see things, and you're floating and it's quiet. It's just a new way to see that place.
Change up your perspective by getting on the water in a beautiful, foldable Oeru kayak. Learn more at www.orukayak.com. That's www.orukayak.com. I know a lot of people take on trail families. Did you do that when you were hiking?
There were several. It's very rare to just stick to just one from Georgia to Maine. But I remember showing up at Amicalola Falls because I did the approach trail. And I remember showing up and there was a guy, and he and I were grunting up the stairs alongside the falls at around the same rate. We'd go up a few flights and then we'd pant. We'd go up a few flights and pant. And by the time we got to the top of the falls, he was like, well, I guess we're a trail family now. His name's Older Dog, and he was with a guy named MacGyver. And the two of them had attempted a through hike the previous year, and it had to bow out due to various injuries. And they were trying again this year. Older Dog wanted to hike the entire trail over again, and MacGyver wanted to hike the first 100 miles, and if his foot was holding up, wanted to bounce up, I think, to New York, where he got off the previous year, and carry on from New York to Katahdin. But for those first 100 miles, the three of us were inseparable. You know, we hiked most of the way together. I don't know that I would have finished my hike without them. I don't know that I would have gotten past those first 100 miles. They helped me out more than I could begin to tell you. I wish I had taken a photo of what my tent looked like the first time I set it up on the trail. I mean, it was a mess, but they were so supportive, so encouraging. I remember when we got to, when we crossed the North Carolina-Georgia border, we set up our tents about a mile or two after. Set up our tents, and they brought out a surprise, and they'd gotten me a bottle of bourbon to congratulate me on finishing my first state. And I still have the bag that they'd given me that bottle in, because one of them had written a lovely little poem on it. And it's one of the things I think I'm going to treasure for a long time, that I hope I get to keep for a long time, and that I hope doesn't disintegrate in the process of aging.
Here's that theme of erosion again. I love the patterns that arise in Rahawa's work.
My goal was to create a library of Black excellence along the Appalachian Trail. I would bring a book by a Black author that meant a lot to me, and I would take them up these mountains, show them these amazing views, and take a photo of them.
Recently, BuzzFeed published an essay by Rahawa entitled How Black Books Lit My Way Along the Appalachian Trail. If you haven't read it, you'll find it in the show notes or via the episode page on she-explorers.com. I hope you'll read it. I think it's important to know where she's coming from. It profiles the book project she describes, but it says so much more.
Because so much of this country's history and access to nature has been particular, has been one of exclusion. Someone like me was never meant to hike the Appalachian Trail. And I wanted to show people that this was a place that they belonged, that this was a place where these books belonged. And I would leave these books along the way at the Appalachian Trail shelters that ran from Georgia to Maine. And I'd leave little notes saying, listen, this is part of a project. Please feel free to flip around. People would leave books. You know, there are a million copies of Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings or many copies of Bryson's Walk in the Woods. But I'd leave these books and say, hey, listen, this is a book. This is what it's about. And you might get a kick out of it. You might like it. You might not. But give it a shot, because there are so many days where it rains. We'll decide to have a late start to their morning to see if the sky is clear. People get to a shelter early and decide to call it a day and want to read a little bit. And I would leave my information. And some people reached out to me. Some people said, hey, listen, I saw this book at this shelter and I read a little bit of it and I liked it. Or it didn't really do much for me. Or this is a pretty cool project. Just wanted to let you know I saw it. By and large, the feedback was positive.
I read that you said that you thought it was important to have Black intellect on the trail, not just Black bodies. You know, even as a woman, you can be just valued for your body. And the idea of elevating these writers and their books through that project, I thought that was just really great.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I also wanted company. I wanted to draw strength from these writers the way I had my entire life. I would go weeks without seeing Black people. I remember getting to a certain point in Virginia, and, you know, there were a bunch of Black people in a supermarket. And I was just beaming at every single person. And it didn't dawn on me that I just looked like someone who needed help, because, you know, I was just completely smiling as widely as I could because I was just so happy to see someone who looked like me.
Rahawa wrote that she saw just one Black person on the trail. In fact, the Appalachian Trail, and through hiking in general, is known for being very white. It's not something we talk a whole lot about.
It's a very, very small population. The Captain, he has a house. It's called The Captain's in Virginia. I want to say maybe 800 miles in-ish. And he lets people camp. He's got this big lawn, and you can camp on it. You zip line across. It's funny. There's like this little seated zip line, and you and your pack zip line across this creek. And you land at The Captain's, and there's soda. You could camp. There's Wi-Fi. There's electricity, so you can recharge your phone. It's a wonderful place to stay. And he was blunt. He came up to me and he said, I think it's great that a Black woman is hiking the Appalachian Trail. I haven't seen many. And please send me a summit photo when you get to Katahdin.
How did that make you feel?
It made me feel wonderful. The trail is supposed to be a great equalizer. People say it doesn't matter where you came from. It doesn't matter what your race is or your religion or how much money you made. We're all just hikers. And that has a way of flattening the experience, you know? It's like when people say, I don't see color. And it's like, that's not okay. that is in itself a form of racism. And it's not meant to chastise people, but a way of saying, listen, I'm glad that you see me as an equal, but you need to recognize that my experience as a Black woman hiking this trail is way different than yours. I need that acknowledgement from you. I also think it's a way to disengage, intentional or otherwise, from what people who look like me might be experiencing and why there might not be more.
That comes back to that privilege that you mentioned again, even though you mentioned the privileges being not just around race, but also around your physical health and your ability to have that time in your life to spend 6 months hiking. But saying that statement that this is a great equalizer, the person who says it, that matters.
I get where they're coming from. You know, like I want to emphasize that this is something that comes from a place of tolerance in their hearts. I experienced very little cruelty or ignorance from through hikers, period. It really was a very welcoming and a very tolerant and a very open community. I felt very safe and very... I felt very safe among people. The last thing that I want is for a listener of color to hear what I'm saying and to think, okay, clearly this Appalachian Trail is too dangerous. I was thinking about it, but now I'm not going to do it. You know, that's not what I want. But people of color are going to have a different hike. They're going to be vigilant in a way that white hikers don't have to be. And I think something that a hiker of color should brace for is a certain ignorance from other hikers about what their hike is like for them. And I will say that most hikers, people who said trail is a great equalizer, when I explained what I was feeling as I hiked and how this hike was for me, there wasn't any pushback. They said, you know, I'd never really thought about it like that. And I think a lot of that has to do with the kind of people that the trail attracts. Very few people said, how dare you? You know, I'm trying to come from a good place and you're saying all of these things to make me feel bad. People listened. People were willing to hear and to learn. And that mattered. That made a huge difference, at least on my hike.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds wonderful that people were receptive to what you had to say. Does it ever get tiring having to explain that?
Yeah, I mean, of course it does. But it's better than the alternative, right? It's better than being fearful. It's better than not feeling safe. It's better than having people who aren't willing to listen. You know, like if the worst thing that I have to fear is needing to take an extra 10 minutes from my day to explain my experience to someone who genuinely wants to learn and grow, it's not the worst life. You know, like it's much better than what came before it.
I love that you used what was a very personal experience to educate others.
I just don't want people to fear the trail. I mean, there's a lot of fear going on right now. I mean, we haven't talked about politics, and it's a difficult time not to talk about politics, especially when we're talking about something that requires maximum vulnerability. One of the reasons why many people choose the Appalachian Trail is because of its proximity to many towns along the way. There's Verizon coverage up and down the trail for most of it. You're never really, really far away. You can get to help easier than you would on, say, the northwestern part of the PCT or along many stretches of the CDT. But I'm trying to find a way to phrase this, and I know you're going to edit it, but it's going to be rough for hikers of color, I think, in the coming years. I don't think they're going to have the easiest time. Not on the trail itself, per se, but walking through the trail towns, doing all the non-trail stuff that goes into a hike.
And that's the stuff that people don't always think about before the trail.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And you did say in that interview that I read that if you were planning a through hike for this year, you're not sure you would go.
No, I'm not. I'm not sure that I would go. I mean, maybe I would. I don't know how to phrase this. I don't know if I'd be able to hike the Appalachian Trail this year while feeling an acceptable level of fear. And I know I just said I don't want people to think the Appalachian Trail is a place that they should be afraid of. I want people to hike the trail. I want hikers of color to hike the trail. But I'm talking about me as who I am, as somebody with the kind of anxiety that I have. I do not know that I, Rahala, would be able to hike the trail this year.
Have you had any women of color reach out to you who have through hiked or who want to through hike?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've encouraged all of them to go, just to be cautious, to be smart about it, everything that they do. But nothing should stop them. You know, this is one of those times where it's like, I don't know that I would be able to take my own advice, but I urge others to do so.
At this point, I've been talking with Rahala for about an hour. We talked so much about her writing and the BuzzFeed article in particular that I was starting to feel conscious of the time and the subject matter. I feel kind of bad. Like, I feel like because there's so much to talk to you about, I feel like we focused primarily on your race, and I know there's so much more to a through hike than that, and to you than that. I just want to say that.
Yeah, well, we can shift away. Ask away.
We got to talking about another kind of small beauty, trail angels.
I myself have hundreds of those stories. I mean, trail angels, you know, they're not just people who show up at a trailhead and they have soda. Those people are wonderful too. Please, more of those people. Definitely. Of course. But they're also just people who stop, who ask you what you need. Even if you're just getting a hitch into town, people who ask, do you want me to swing by the supermarket so you can resupply before I drop you off at the hostel? There are just so many little things that people do to help you. And especially when you're in places that know that hikers are coming through. Many of the trail towns are very proud of hikers, very proud of the hiking community, and are very supportive as a result. I was so close to quitting, I want to say around a little bit after Port Clinton, and I had a trail angel who came to the hostel where I was staying, drove me down 50 miles so that I can go to an outfitter to pick up these boots, and drove me back to the hostel. And of course, I paid for gas. I was grateful, you know? But the fact that he was willing to take the time to shuttle me on his day off to get shoes, I think that might be the closest I'd come to quitting the trail, was just being in this excruciating pain. and of course it's disheartening when you've hiked over 1,000 miles and you've slowed to a crawl and you're wondering, why can't you do more? This person took me down to this outfitter and helped me get this shoe, and it made all the difference.
I asked whether she would through hike again.
When I finished the Appalachian Trail and I hobbled down Katahdin, I remember saying, never again. Once was enough. You know, I'm glad I did it, but I just, you know, I don't want to take 6 months away from my life again. I don't want to feel this much pain again. I'm done. And I kid you not, 2 weeks later, I was up at 3 a.m. in the privacy of my room on my laptop looking at PCT through hiking blogs. Because that's what happens. It's hard not to want more of it because it's such a magical experience. Yes, your feet will hurt. You will ache. You'll be hungry, sure. But it's also one of the most amazing and fulfilling things that I think anyone will do in their lives. I think it's important to note that. But yeah, I think I would do the PCT. And I think my friend Alex's Instagram, you know, the guy who thru-hiked the PCT last year, really sold me on it. You know, pictures have a way of doing that.
All that, the big beauty.
Yeah, but it's also about how long will these trails exist in the way that they exist right now. Yes, it's a very high precipitation year for California, right? And that's great, but the desert is still the desert. Those first 700 miles of California are still very dry. You know, the first walking through New Mexico on the CDT, it's not like it's going to get easier. You know, it's not like there are going to be more water sources. And so that's something I think about. I am afraid of wildfire season in the Pacific Northwest. I don't see fewer fires happening, you know? And so when I think about what hiking the PCT will look like in, like, say, 2050, not that I want to hike in 2050. I hope I hike way before then. But what I think it'll look like, I think it'll be very different. And I want to experience this beauty while I still can, and while it's still here, as accessible as it is right now.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add about your experience about through hiking?
We'll say this as a parting words. If you are thinking about a through hike, do it. Do what you need to do to finish it. Save up what you need to save up. Many people have to stop their through hikes because they simply didn't save up enough. And that's a very real concern, and that's a very serious limitation. But if you're thinking about it, and if you're in a position where you can take 6 months off and try to do something like it, and it's something that's calling to you, and it's something that you keep thinking about on and off and keep putting off, stop putting it off. Find a way to do it, because your life won't be the same after. That includes you, Gail.
I know. You're talking to me. You can find Rahawa on Twitter and Instagram via her handle at Rahawa Hale. That's at RahawaHale. I'm so glad she shared her AT experience with me and you all. I love that she called me out on my through hike fascination. A couple of quick items before I let you go. First, a listener let me know that we were using the term tribe without acknowledging its origin. This occurred in the origin story, Being Here and Backcountry Bonding. The listener is of Crow Indian heritage. She noted that her people were living in tribes when Europeans arrived, and they were made to feel negatively about their way of life. And of course, worse than just negatively. I appreciate her letting me know, and I'll be more conscious of the wording in the future. Second, I just wanted to share that I'm going to try to take a hike a week. And that's just something personal that I'm looking to do, but I just wanted to let you guys know. Thanks to our sponsor, Org Kayak. The right support makes a huge difference. Music is by Broke for Free, Little Glass Men, Tours, Chris Zabriskie, and Lee Rosevere. Our next episode is about mental health in the outdoors, and it comes out in 2 weeks. Until then, have fun out there.